A podcast of the cinema.
We have a guest.
We have a guest. So we'll be like real podcasters. We're going to introduce ourselves and then introduce the guest right. And do all the things right like we're supposed to.
We're not going to goof around for 15 minutes no. Talking about soup.
Maybe whatever. We will. I don't know. Maybe if our guest wants to. You're Dave White, film critic for The Wrap and other locations. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor at The Wrap.
Kind of just that location, really.
At the moment, yes, but you have a long history. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor at The Wrap, film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. And we're delighted to have joining us once again today one of our favorite guests, one of your favorite guests, listeners, Manola Dargis from The New York Times is here.
Hi.
Welcome.
Happy Saturday.
So we're going to talk about, obviously, your much-discussed list from earlier this month with A.O. Scott of the best films of the 21st century thus far. But first, we're just having a conversation before we got started about The House and how Warner Brothers isn't screening it for the press. And it's been a while since a major studio has just not shown a film.
I like The House. I like the techno. I like the garage.
What about Deep House?
I really like Deep House.
So Warner Brothers has announced they are not screening this film for critics, and there used to be a periodically, like, that'd be a thing. I remember we going to a lot of midnight movies on Thursdays, mm-hmm. back before the show started at like 7:30 on Thursday nights. And then lately, I think there's enough of an internet sort of media presence and kind of people who are inside baseball about movies that they're like, oh, if you're not showing it to the press, then it must be a stink burger. So whatever you were trying to alleviate not showing it to the press was going to come out badly anyway. So anyway, this decision to not screen it kind of comes on the heels of several weeks of articles freaking out about Rotten Tomatoes. And oh my God, it's like, that's why Baywatch failed. And that's why, you know, Pirates underperformed and Mummy and blah, blah, blah.
Baywatch failed because it was a mountain of human feces.
Yeah, I mean, talk about shooting the messenger. I don't know that you can pin this on Rotten Tomatoes.
I don't really understand. I mean, of course, we talk about this, and this is not saying anything that hasn't been discussed, but, you know, they love us when they want us, and
sure.
they want our help, particularly in the fall, particularly with movies that they believe are going to get awards, particularly movies that they feel like they need to sell to the public.
Yeah.
And then they blame us when their terrible movies go south. And I don't really... I mean, what's interesting to me is that a movie with Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler is going to open without showing to the critics, and you'd sometimes think that what if their representation, you know, teams think about that. Doesn't it look really bad? Doesn't it reflect badly on them?
Sure.
And I don't know.
It's not like they're Adam Sandler, like where the usually critics aren't nice to them. I mean, I'd say both Poehler and Ferrell, for the most part, have enjoyed a pretty good run of critics liking their films.
Right, even bad ones.
Yeah.
Because, so, you know, Amy Poehler's really charming, so you can just say, oh, yeah, Sisters, wasn't that the name?
Yeah. I mean, they showed us that Daddy's Home, is that what that movie's called?
Yeah, that terrible thing.
So, yeah, I fear the worst.
I was thinking about Sisters when I heard about this, because I thought, that's not a good movie.
Mm-mm.
But I got to watch Tina Fey and Amy Poehler have fun for like 90 minutes.
And that's why I was there.
And it was and that was an okay enough time for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like they're just standing around, smiling at each other, this little bit of garbage story, some nonsense, and you're like, you know, I like them. And that radiates off the screen, and you forgive a lot of things. And
yes.
I feel that way about Will Ferrell, hit and miss.
This is solidly average.
Solidly below average, but nonetheless I went.
So anyway,
every summer this happens, right? I mean, every summer there is some terrible, terrible film that opens, and the critics pre-hate it before the opening day, and then the audience, as you said off the microphone before we started, Manola, that they smell a turd, and it's not just the critics, it's the people, the audience. audiences that people like Dwayne The Rock Johnson keep saying things like, "I made this. We made this for the audiences,
not for the critics,
the fans, yeah. The fans, not the critics." And, well, you know what? They think your movie is stupid and terrible too, and they didn't go.
If we didn't destroy Transformers 1 through 4, you are not pinning 5 on us. Like, if this is underperforming, it's not our fault.
Nicely put.
These are folks who make a badge of honor out of announcing on the internet, "I don't listen to the critics. I don't read them." Mm.
Until they do.
If that's the case, then you chose not to go see Baywatch or The Mummy or whatever the hell else. I guess Transformers is underperforming.
Apparently so, yeah.
Yeah. From what you told me, I guess, this morning. And then, obviously, it ain't my fault.
No, it's not the fault of a studio that is deciding that there needs to be a fifth movie in a franchise that needs to recycle The Mummy. Gee, didn't that just star Brendan Fraser? And why is Tom Cruise in that? I mean, these are very confusing movies. And Baywatch, isn't that like still on rerun someplace?
Probably,
yes.
I mean, is that what people want to see Dwayne Johnson? They certainly want to see him in the Fast Furious movies.
Sure,
you know, so... Explain to me this.
Well, a couple of years ago, this all came up with Lone Ranger, which it opened badly here. And then when they were doing the European press, Johnny Depp and Armie Hammer and Jerry Bruckheimer took it upon themselves to say that, American critics decided beforehand they were going to hate it, and they were reviewing the budget and blah, blah,
they
blah.
They all got
and
together.
We got together as a cabal, you know, and because you know how
at my house, right? We met.
The finger sandwiches were great. Because we always agree on everything. And we decided we were going to sink this movie, and that's why audiences didn't go. And I wrote about it at the time, and I said, if critics could sink a movie, like Michael Bay would work at Starbucks, and if critics could make a movie a hit, like all the studios would be courting the Dardenne brothers.
Exactly.
You know, so it's weird that suddenly we have this power when usually we are, you know, unless it's award season and they really need us to like push their sort of middle brow product to the NPR listening audience, for the most part, they could care less if we live or die.
Or to encourage the Academy to go this way or that way.
Exactly. But so it's odd, these sudden moments that we are imbued with this power.
No, but, you know, I'm perfectly fine I'm fine with the studios having this kind of contentious relationship with critics. I think, you know, for me, it's much worse that there's coziness among critics and studios. It's really bad. And
true.
I think it's really terrible. And I think it kind of convinces people at the studios that somehow that everyone can be kind of swayed one way or another. Because there are people who are just going to, based on a trailer, get excited about a movie. And then there are people who are going to go actually watch the movie and announce, "Oh, you know what? This is terrible. Great trailer, terrible movie." And I think, you know, I'd much have, you know, it's not to say that it needs to be necessarily adversarial, but I have no problem the studio's not really, you know, in my fantasy world, we would review movies, for instance, after they had been released, you know, to kind of further separate us from that kind of commercial consideration.
Right.
It would be, I think I would like that much better. That's just not how the world works, certainly not the one I operate in, not the one that employs me, so.
Exactly, like we write for those journals that, you know, a year later will let you know what they thought about, you know.
Here are my 5,000 words on the death of the moon. Exactly.
So you and Mr. Scott just did this list, and
speaking of articles going around the internet,
indeed, yes, much buzzed about. Just out of curiosity, what was the impetus?
There's a couple different things. One, and Tony has talked about this openly, so I feel empowered to do so as well. One is really to drive traffic to the site. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things, the larger consideration we have to think about is the New York Times is now is really kind of, it's digital first, you know, and it is expanding. And it needs, and it's been very open, and you can read about it. People who are interested in American journalism should read about it. There's a 2020 report. It's not very long, and it will actually talk about what's going on at the paper, if you're interested in transparency and actually the history. And, you know, the real challenge is to try to find a digital audience, you know, and you just have to think about mainstream newspapers like the Washington Post, owned by a billionaire, by the way, and the New York Times and other places. They know how to reach the print audience. They did it brilliantly for a very long time. And this is a brand new world. And so there's different things. And one of the things that I know that we've been accused of, Tony and me, and just the paper at large, is like clickbait, you know. And I would say that, okay, I think that a lot of things are clickbait, you know. I think anything with the word Trump is clickbait at this point, in the headline. But I would say, well, what is behind that is in terms of you know, survival. And I think that it's what is happening right now in American journalism is the crisis has not stopped just because subscriptions are up at the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Right.
You know, it's really a problem. And then there are other things that are part of the consideration, and this is really important both to Tony Scott and to myself, is really what I see is the crisis in foreign language film distribution in the United States, you know, which is really terrible and has just gotten worse and worse and worse. And it's really upsetting and very alarming. And we have this tool, for instance, at the Times that we can actually see, like, readership. If a movie has stars and is backed by a studio, which means if it's backed by a studio, it has a huge advertising budget and it's in everyone's face. And so everyone knows about it. They have great awareness of something like the recent King Kong movie, which is called Kong. Right?
It was just Kong Skull Island.
Kong Skull, whatever it was. it was Kong. It was another Kong movie.
Kong Goes Hawaiian.
Exactly. So there's a lot of awareness. It's those things that are there that are built in, including a huge advertising budget. So it's there. You know, a small, Romanian movie or a Belgian movie or a French or an Argentine movie does not have that advantage. How do you get the audience interested in that? This is not news. There's a great crisis in terms of the art film audience and the graying and now white herring of the white of the art film audience. And it's really about how to get people into cinemas, you know, and it's really very disturbing to me that a movie like, you know, the recent King Kong movie will have, like, hundreds of thousands of people are interested in reading that review, and you have, like, a positive review of a foreign language film, and it's really hard to kind of break through to people. And this is not just, you know, at the New York Times. It's everywhere.
Oh,
and
sure.
You talk to any distributor that distributes foreign language films, and it's a crisis.
Yeah.
So what do you do, and how do you reach new readers and also kind of try to encourage them to kind of broaden their horizons beyond The Dark Knight, you know? How do you do that? A movie I really like, you know?
Yeah.
And in fact, I gave it a great, a very positive review. This is really trying to figure out how to get people interested in movies that aren't being pre-sold.
Sure.
You know, that's a huge challenge, and I think anyone who cares about cinema needs to care about that.
Yeah.
So, yes, it was about driving traffic to the site, but there's another, I don't mean it's not noble or, you know, but there's another reason. It's really about trying to, like, help.
Well, and I think it's one
and
thing.
Encourage.
It's one thing to write something that you know is going to be clickbait, which, and you can judge whether or not clickbait is in and of itself a good or bad thing. But it's like, and now that you're here, let's talk about Yee-Yee. You know,
yeah,
I mean, so it's not
exactly.
Like it's not like you are then exacerbating the problem by getting a bunch of people to click on something to hear about movies they already knew about and already thought about and already were aware of anyway.
And then the other challenge that I just say is that we have a situation now, and I think I may have mentioned on this program. I'm not sure this podcast before.
We'll take program.
I like program.
We're a salon.
A salon. I'm here in the salon. Is that
of Solange?
Let's say in New York City, for example, you have approximately 1,000 features opening. How, you know, and we were having these
in a year.
Yeah.
And that means sometimes there are certain weeks when there are 25 new movies.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you get people to go see the movies? How do you cut through that noise? The signal-to-noise ratio is really important, and that's become another challenge for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that, you know, lists seem very reductive, and but, you know, most critics I know like to do their top 10 at the end of the year, so
sure.
Please, number one. and number two, it's a way of kind of helping to cut through the noise. You know, it's about trying to figure out how to put the movies we care about in front of readers. I think this is a huge challenge. I can talk for a really long time about this.
Why don't you?
Please. The floor is yours, ma'am.
I think sometimes I feel like movie critics, we tend to know one another, and we tend to kind of, we see the same movies, and like, oh, we all know that movie. We've seen that movie.
Yes.
How many people, really smart people, who will read a Toni Morrison book, who will read Jonathan Levin actually go see a movie like The
Yeah.
I don't know a lot of them, to be honest.
Who paid attention to us when we, as a group, that year all said, see Yi Yi.
Yeah.
Watch that movie. Who did it? And you don't, you never know.
No,
unless they contact you.
Right. And yeah. So this is a huge, and so I think sometimes, and this is, I think, again, this is a collective challenge for, is trying to figure out how we can stop maybe talking to one another and talking more to people.
Sure, no.
And I think, you know, I think podcasts are great ways to do that. I do think that there is a kind of insularity in certain strains of contemporary film criticism where, well, of course, you know, that's not Bellatar's best movie. And you know what? Most people don't know who the Bellatar is.
Right.
And to assume that is really arrogant. And who are you talking to? Are you just talking to yourself?
One of the things I always used to try to do when I wrote for Movies.com, which is no one's idea of a prestige outlet, where it's a ticket buying site, you know. I knew who the readers were because they screamed at me and called me a fat F word as often as they could. But I knew if I was reviewing something from, if I was reviewing one of the Romanian films, I would spend the first chunk of that review trying to give as much, like, quick background information, like, here's what this is, here's where it comes from, here's this director, this is why it matters to me, and this is what I think of the film. And that was always, I always felt like a weird, it always felt very weird to me to do that because I didn't want to be condescending.
Exactly.
In that
right,
way,
right.
Where you say, well, you don't know who this is.
Right, blah, 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 blah. I know.
But the truth is that most folks don't know who that is, nor do they care, and they're already mad at you for trying to make them watch a Romanian film.
But I'll tell you, and you know, you dismiss me when I say this often, but I think
I know what you're going to say.
No, I think one of Dave's great strengths as a writer is as a docent, somebody who sort of like will make, you know, I'd say there's at least a dozen people who listen to this podcast who saw The Touring Horse only on his recommendation. Because Dave has a way of taking a movie that sounds completely impenetrable and explaining to you why you might find it interesting and why you should see it.
Here's what it is, I think, that if you're going to praise me for a moment, which I don't mind at all, I'm a good hammer. Like, I will repeat and repeat and repeat. You must see this film. Over the course of many episodes of the show, I'll be like, why haven't y'all watched this movie?
But back when you wrote for Movies.com and you had one shot at it, you were still, I think, doing a really good job of assuming a voice that was unthreatening, but at the same time, super knowledgeable and giving people a hook into a movie they might otherwise never look at in a million
years. I clowned them into wanting to see it.
Basically, yes.
But, you know, I do that with jokes, you know, when I can, or like, you know, it's, I mean, part of it is just, you know, trying to seduce people. And, you
put
know,
squash in the food processor and hit it in the macaroni and cheese.
You know, and part of this is access, too. I mean, let's just be realistic. Right, a lot of the movies that we like, people actually don't have access to. I mean, there's this new Bertrand Tavernier film, My Journey Through French Cinema, which is quite wonderful. But it opened on Friday, and it only opened in New York and Los Angeles. It will be opening in other cities, and you can go to cohenmedia.net to look up where it is opening, and I highly recommend it. But, you know, it's also access.
Sure.
And then there's the more uncomfortable things about watching subtitles on televisions. And I know, and some people like to watch movies on their computers and their laptops and, you know,
their phones,
and those words keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So that is a real challenge.
Sure.
You know, it really is. But some of this is habit, some of it is about access. It's just, you know, it's not fashionable the way it was once upon a time that you had to see the new Truffaut.
Exactly, yeah. Like in the 60s and the 70s, you know, smart people went to see the new Fellini. Like, we just did a club meeting where we watched An Unmarried Woman on Netflix. And you know, the teenage daughters all talk, you know, oh, let's talk about the new Wertmuller, you know.
And that was very, that was very influential. That moment in that film was very influential to me. It's something I kept with me as I grew up, because I grew up in tiny little towns. Mm-hmm. But we got the newspaper from the big city far away, or we got the cable channel mm-hmm. from Los Angeles, wherever it was we were living, the big city closer to us, there was some media that was available to me so I could see movie ads mm-hmm. for films like Amarcord, you know, mm-hmm. when I was a kid, and thinking, that's rated R, I can never see it. It's from Italy, I know that. And someday I'll be a grown-up person and I'll get to go watch that movie mm-hmm. that you have to read, which is bizarre to me. And I remember as a kid, I was watching HBO and an unmarried woman came on. And it was like, yay, an R-rated movie. My parents are not home. I'm going to watch this. And the young teenage daughter in the movie, you know, sophisticated Manhattan teenager, talking about the latest Lena Wertmüller film being flawed. And I thought, she's got the life. Like, she gets to go to see that film. Why can't I? Oh, that's right. I live in Roswell, New Mexico.
Well, you know,
and so that I held on to that mm-hmm. because in my head, I knew where I wanted to go, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. and I did not have access.
Right.
But I was like chomping at it to get that access someday when I was, you know, a grown person.
And we have peers of a certain age who I know kind of poo-poo Siskel and Ebert, but say what you will about them, those guys got me out of the house to see Diva and mm-hmm. like My Dinner with Andre and Entre Nous and all mm-hmm. these sort of like early 80s art house stuff when I was a teenager mm-hmm. that otherwise I would have maybe picked up somewhere else, but like that really kind of drove home, like, oh yeah, these are important movies, I need to go see it. And there's no national voice with that kind of impact because there's so many voices on
the
internet.
It's been mm-hmm. so dispersed that no one voice can. I mean, I think we're all trying the best we can, but there's a lot of chatter out there.
Of course.
It's very, very difficult. I'll just, one last thing is, I mean, I think, you know, the rise of American independent cinema has been really calamitous for foreign film distribution, you mm-hmm. know, in terms of that audience, you know, it had really leached it, you know, and it's great, you know, it's great. There's really a kind of American independence. I go to Sundance every year, but it really kind of took that. It's a shame that you couldn't have both. And it really is a shame.
No, I always tell people when you're going to a film festival, dive deep into the foreign films and the docs because they had the most choices and like had to make the hardest picks to decide what went in and what
and
didn't.
And they may not get actual distribution.
And yeah, exactly. And you may never see them again.
Right,
there was a Brazilian film last year at Outfest called The Cult.
Oh, yeah. That was a good
bizarre little low-budget sci-fi movie about a future where everyone just lies around all day and has like aesthetically pleasing sex, and it's such a weird little movie.
Everyone else has left the planet.
I will never get another chance to look at this if I don't go.
And aren't
now.
You glad that you saw it?
And I did. Yeah. The thing about access, returning to that for just a moment before we, the list itself. Mm. Living in Los Angeles or New York, I can hear you say, and I can read the pieces about the disastrous box office for foreign language films. And yet I think to myself, don't affect me. I'm going because it's opening here. Mm-hmm. Maybe
in Los Angeles because we do not have the same access
as
New York.
Absolutely. That is correct. Because
has your Lob Diaz movie opened here
yet? Nope, not yet. And I talked to I reviewed The Woman Who Left for The Wrap last
month.
Such a good movie. It opened in New York. It has not come to Los Angeles yet. And the Kino guy, Kino Lorber, publicist, said, we're hoping Cine Family, we're hoping A Night at the Hammer, mm-hmm. maybe, mm-hmm. you know? And I was like, I get it. I know. And that's upsetting to me because I had to watch it on my laptop mm-hmm. to review it. Mm-hmm. And I want to see it on a screen. I want to go again. I thought it was so great. And so that is a... The thing, the reality is that I will hammer on that film on this podcast until it comes out on Blu-ray from Kino Lorber, and then I'll hammer it on it again. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And people listening to this show, I hope, if y'all know what's good for you, maybe they'll watch it, mm-hmm. you know.
Because some of you will love it. You will love it as much as Dave and
it's
as much
so
as
beautiful.
I do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's unlike any other kind of cinema. And we complain all the time that movies are all alike, and then we keep going to these franchises again and again, and you're thinking, but you could see something, if you have the access, different. Why not be adventurous?
I want to throw out just a quick question to you, because this is it came up a lot at Cannes this year. Do you think that Netflix is doing a good job of getting smaller films out there, or do you think that the stuff that they are acquiring is then getting lost without a trace?
Well, we haven't had that much kind of... I mean, examples are, Beast of No Nation?
Well, they produced Beast of No Nation and a few, but they acquired, like... What was the movie?
Was that movie at Sundance that was really nice that just went right to Netflix?
Oh, the one with Elijah Wood and... I forget the title.
I'm so sorry, but I really liked that, and I was so sad that it didn't actually open on screens. I thought it really deserved a theatrical release. I don't think we know yet, and I think what I really resent deeply about Netflix is the fact that they're, you know, that they just want us to, you know, follow, do their bidding, basically. And that, I mean, I like the model that Amazon is doing. It's going to, yes, stream these, but it's
dedicated. But first, we're going to theaters.
But they're doing a theatrical release. And, you know, a movie like the Okja, the Bong Joon-ho movie, should be seen on the biggest screen you can find. It is amazing looking. It is just you sit there with your eyeballs going, woo, you know, it's Looney Tune eyeball time, you know. They're going, woo, out of your sockets, because it's so fabulous. And why would you deny the audience that unless you're just so completely driven? I mean, they're only, they're all about their subscriptions, and they're just, that's all they're interested in. They're not interested in the material, they're just interested in their subscribers.
True. Although I think there's also there's a weird double-edged sword there. For like, for example, they want to open, they are opening Okja for like an Oscar run, and they're opening at the IPIC. Like, that's the one theater in LA that would even do it, because I think a lot of theaters don't like Netflix and don't want to support them. I mean, when they did their Oscar run of Beasts of No Nation, I think it was at the downtown Independent, like, they literally just four walls.
We just don't know if that's a contractual obligation, though, that they have to open it. I mean, there are these, you know, is it a contractual obligation that they actually have to open it theatrically, you know, so they'll just open it in a small, you know, for 1 week?
I'm assuming it's for Oscar runs. I don't know.
Yes, but I think that's contractual, that you actually have to do it for an Oscar run.
Yeah, but I do know there are theaters that a lot of them have turned them down. I mean, they did get into, I think, one of the Lemleys with Five Came Back. But for the most part, I think they've had a hard time finding theaters that will show them, because theaters sort of look at them as the enemy.
I just don't understand why they need to take an adversarial position, but you just feel like it's, you know, their way or forget it, you know. And I think it's like that, you know, television and movies have had a symbiotic relationship since the introduction of television. It's a long, you know, television was very helpful to the movies and vice versa. So they've had this very...
I don't know. I mean, I think it's adversarial, actually.
No, I mean, I disagree. I mean, we can talk about that. But
okay,
I would say, but it, you know, and even in the basic terms of, like, talent coming out of television and going, like Arthur Penn, and going in. So, you know, I've always seen it as that. And certainly, economically, it turned out to be very good. Yes, it seemed
in
very
the long run. Yeah.
Yes, but there are people who knew in the long run that it would be. So, I don't understand why Netflix. You know, this. I don't understand why they're having this incredibly adversarial position, because they're just making enemies of everybody. But, you know, they're very wealthy. I'm not. Obviously, they know some things that I don't. So.
No, you're right, though. I mean, because Amazon is, at least they'll hook up with a Roadside Attractions or a Lionsgate or whoever, and get their stuff out there and into theaters.
They have
first,
serious
you know.
Movie people who are there running their theatrical distribution arm. You know, they're very committed to it. So, whatever different reasons, and that's exciting and that's great, because Amazon is doing some great things.
Certainly, I mean, I don't know. I see sort of two different sides of it. Because on the one hand, yes, a lot of the original Netflix stuff, especially like Okja, you're right, totally needs to be seen in the theater and should get should be allowed to have a theatrical life outside of 1 week in New York and L.A. But I think also that there are movies that would otherwise just not get the eyeballs on them had they not been on Netflix. Like, the one I always cite is a movie that I loved from last year called Take Me to the River.
Mm-hmm.
I get a little email every day that the rap sends me, or some outside firm sends it, that tells me who's been clicking on my articles, or like how many clicks my articles have gotten. And for a long stretch of time, in the top 10 that I get every day would be my review of Take Me to the River, a movie that barely opened theatrically, mm-hmm. but was on Netflix, I think very prominently on Netflix. And I think that kind of, that told me that people were watching the movie and then going to the Rotten Tomatoes page where there weren't a ton of reviews.
I'm not against Netflix. I pay them every single month, you know? I'm not that...
I understand.
My only complaint is that they're not also doing theatrical.
No, you're
like,
right.
It's going to go. Like, you know, streaming is just part of the echo. It's part of the system that we have now. Okay,
sure.
Fine. I like theatrical, you know. I'm old, but I just resent their kind of contempt and disregard for, you know, movies as something that you actually do go to a cinema and
sure.
you watch.
No, I agree. And it seems they're also kind of shooting themselves in the foot, I think, as far as their awards ambitions, because when you look at Amazon, like Manchester by the Sea got a ton of nominations because they released it theatrically like a movie. And if Netflix could do that and, like, you know, give themselves 2 months in theaters before it streams or whatever, that could be a whole different story for them.
Netflix is just, it's like a black box, you know? They don't release their numbers.
Right.
They just say, trust us, everyone's watching us. Just trust us. And people are going, release the numbers, show us the numbers. And, you know, they are also putting some good movies into theaters. So anytime anyone does that, you know, that's great. I
sure.
just wish that they, you know, would not be, they should be a force for good.
Fair enough.
I don't have an opinion about it. I just like that people were protesting that it can't. That made me happy.
I
like some rabble rousing.
I want to say that there was some misinformation because I was at the Okja, the first press screening.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And the reason that people started booing initially, myself included, and I just love booing at Cannes, let me just tell you, it is very, very delightful, is because it was being projected in incorrect aspect ratio.
Well, I heard it started like 3 times or something, right?
It did, and it just went on for, close to about 10 minutes where it was misprojected. And you could just see it, and everyone was clapping and then booing because no one was paying attention. And Cannes usually has fantastic projection.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's really, really pleasurable. It's huge screens, really good. It was mind-blowing. And we're just sitting there, and it's like, you cannot see the part of this up. You, like, what the f***?
Mm. Okay.
And so this was really that. And then it was just, it started to feel like it was almost emblematic of a certain kind of contempt for theatrical. Whether that's
metaphor.
Fair. Whether or not it's fair or not. It just was like, ugh. And so the main thing was being misprojected. And you're
right.
You're at the premier film festival in the world. Come on, man.
Total distraction, and then
yes,
we'll get back to the actual topic. How is the new Noah Baumbach?
Well, I don't usually talk about his movies as a critic because I've known him since he was a teenager, and I'm very good friends with his mom.
So
I never review his movies. For instance, like I saw his mother recently in Italy. You know, so it's like for me, it was like, wait a minute. That kid has grown up and become an auteur, you know? So I just don't feel comfortable because there's just no way for me to in any way
Understood.
Give it.
Not to worry. Okay. I did, if I'd known your backstory, I wouldn't have
And his
that.
Mom, by the way, is Georgia Brown, who
yes.
I met when I was at the Village Voice. So many, many, many moons ago.
And is not the subject of the song.
Absolutely not.
Thanks for explaining that
well,
to me.
Well, I'm just saying, what parent, you know,
exactly.
once it's been taken, you know,
yeah.
find another name.
Yeah.
So or the list.
That list, which has inspired people on the internet to make their own lists.
Many.
Hilarious.
So many other
hilarious
many.
Lists.
My favorite one, though, recently, is someone came up with Nick Cage's top 25 movies. And I was just like, I was like, wait, he's made that. And it wasn't even a complete list of the numbers of movies he's made in the 21st century.
He's a busy, busy boy.
Oh, my Lord, as busy as a bee.
He's got castles to pay for or whatever.
Does he still own that castle?
Maybe he had to sell
it. I hope he does. I hope he still owns it because...
I know he had to sell his issue of Action Comics number 1, which broke my heart.
Oh, that's sad.
What, really?
He did,
for
taxes.
That's really tragic.
Whoa.
I know. Sad.
Did I tell you the story of, this is a complete digression, Rosario Dawson talking about how her grandmother had Action number 1?
You did, yes.
and her mother was like, throw it out. Well, this was, you know, at the time of its publication. Her grandmother loved comic books. Her mother loved comic books, and it sort of passed it down to Rosario.
But not her great-grandmother.
But her great-grandmother did not care. Threw it out.
Oh, that's painful.
Good. You've got the list in front of you on paper. So
what can I tell you, gentlemen?
Well, okay. So I think a key thing that was part of this was that you and Mr. Scott had to agree on everything.
Oh, yes.
This was a joint list.
Right. And I think it was kind of somewhat confusing because some people seemed to have thought that the ones that he authored alone and the ones that I authored, the little entries, rather, that I authored alone, that those were our individual picks, and that was not true.
Right.
It's just that we were sharing the task of writing those 10,000 words. Right. That's why our bylines are at the top, you know, joint. Right. It's a joint. Yeah, so we had to, and that was really tricky. I mean, we've been working together for more than a decade, and we're actually very, very good friends, and we get along very well, and he's, you know, incredibly nice person, and I'm just not as nice a person at all. He's very even-tempered. I am not as even-tempered a person, but what? He knows. I know, it's a shock.
We're still Team Manolo.
But, you know, so he, you know, he... But we've worked out a really great, and we've authored, we've co-written a lot of other things, including these conversations that I know some people really love and some people think are the stupidest things ever. But they're really fun for us because it's like, what are you thinking about? I mean, usually it's more planned than that.
Well, you all had that one about a boredom that I thought was great.
Oh, thank you. And that was a response to the kind of cultural vegetables piece that Dan Coase had done in response to dissing a Kelly Reichardt movie.
Right.
And, you know, I kind of in his... Oh, that's a whole other thing. That was about slow cinema, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so for us, the list was, you know, we're co-chief critics, and this was going to go under as like a project of the chief film critics of the New York Times, so we had to agree on this. And so initially, the most difficult part was like, oh my God, there were so many movies. So how do you begin to winnow that? And so... We did, you know, we looked at what had been on our top tens. We looked at what had been the Oscar winners. We looked at awards winners. We also looked at things that had won Cannes, you know, different kind of festival. So we started with a very large pool, and then we started winnowing and winnowing and winnowing and winnowing down. And then it became really hard because we had like initial lists of what we agreed on.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't 25. So right. How do you get to 25? We had wild cards where each of us could pick one. I actually literally do not remember Tony's wild card, and he doesn't either, which is hilarious. So I asked him the other day, I said, do you remember what your wild card was? And he was like, no. Mine was really painful, though, because at the point that I finally picked... So the wild card was something that we reserved after we had come up with our list of, like, the 23 that we could agree on.
Oh, gotcha.
Without bloodshed, right? You know, or screaming in the phone or slamming it down, which, of course, he would never do.
Nobody slams their phone down anymore, Manolo. We've
no,
all got smartphones.
I know. Well,
it's not satisfying unless you throw it across the room.
I know, and then you have to buy a new one.
It's most satisfying when you can throw someone else's phone across the
That's
room.
That's very true. But
or throw it at Naomi Campbell's assistant.
Since he lives in New York and I live in Los Angeles, I'm just... Anyway, so... You know, we finally used our wild cards at the very, very end after finally going through and agreeing, and it was very difficult. And suddenly I just realized, I looked at mine, I was like, oh my God, there wasn't a Wong Kar-wai movie on the list. There wasn't a David Fincher on the list. There was not a Cuarón film on the list. I mean, there were all these filmmakers that I just
There's no Almodovar on that list.
Mm-hmm, there's no Almodovar on the list. There was no Ho Shao Shen on the list. And I sat there, and I just kept thinking about Sophie's Choice. I'm sorry, that sounds really vulgar, but I did. And I was like, oh, Ho Shao Shen. So that's how Ho Shao Shen ended up on the list, and that's how Wong Kar-wai ended up not on the list, and David Fincher ended up. I mean, Tony doesn't, you know, I really wanted Zodiac on the list. Tony doesn't like Zodiac.
No.
And so you could... And there were other films that came really close, like we both really liked Children of Men, but it just didn't make it,
right,
which isn't
right.
to say, I would say, that in another month, it wouldn't have been on the list. I mean, I think that's the
right.
thing.
Always, yeah.
yeah.
You know, ask me tomorrow.
Ask me tomorrow, and my top 10 will be different.
Yeah.
You know, ask me in another year, and I'll look at my original one and think, what was I thinking, you know? Or the movie has faded. And it's not so much that the movies change. The movies are the same. You change, sure, right? Of course. So, and there were things that, you know, I had just adored when they had come out and then looked at it and I was like, yeah, that's so not going to be on my list, you know?
How many movies did you sit and watch again to do this list?
All of them.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. No. I mean, well, not with the original, you know, the original hundreds and hundreds.
Well,
and,
sure,
but, you
no.
Know, but we watched all 25. Yeah, absolutely. Wow, okay. I didn't think that it was possible
to just rely on your memory.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ones that I didn't actually, let me, there were a couple that I didn't. I didn't rewatch Munich. And yeah, so I think a couple of the Facebook source ones I didn't.
Hmm.
But I rewatched almost all of them. Let's put wow. it, let me just, yeah, no, that's, of course.
Because you got time.
No. But, you know, if I'm going to, you know, if we're going to write about these movies, and there were things that I rewatched that I actually didn't write about, so I'm not there, you know.
Mm. You hadn't reviewed the first time around.
Well, no, for this time, I didn't write the entry on it. I mean, it was Tony's idea that we should use Bob Dylan lyrics, and then we both came up with a lot of lyrics, and then for reasons having to do with our workflow, he ended up doing the final version, and he put his name on it, and that's exactly right.
Hmm.
But I had also watched the movie again and just like, that's a really great movie, you know? So, you know, I felt like I really needed to feel really committed to, and you know, something like Munich, I'd seen like 3 or 4 times already. So I felt like I didn't, and it seemed like There Will Be Blood. Like if we're going to put that at number one, I got to rewatch that again.
Sure,
you know, yeah. I got to feel really strongly about this. And I did. So,
Just like thinking about I'm Not There, like, you know, the thing about lists, and I learned this at The Advocate, like, and the reason why people engage with them so much is because it forces people to think for themselves, I would have included this, how dare you leave it out, or how could you put this on there, or you're right, this is a good one, you know, like, those are the three responses to pretty much every item on any list that you're going to get from readers. Like, I'm sitting here thinking, well, I would have gone with Far From Heaven, but, you know.
Sure,
Also, I like Douglas Sirk more than I like Bob Dylan, so, you know, it's a subjective thing, you know.
But for me, I Am Not There is also about identity, and I think identity is one of the great kind of subjects of the 21st century, I mean, mm-hmm. it has been in terms of
social media.
Yeah, well, just identity and fluidity of identity and how we kind of move in identity. So for that was like she really, because I really love, I love him. I love Todd Haynes' work in general. And I love Far From Heaven. I think it's a brilliant movie and I love Sirk. In some ways I feel like Far From Heaven is made more for film critics.
Maybe.
You know, where I just felt like, you know, there are certain movies
I'm not there is made for rock critics.
I mean, I just think there's some movies that just seem more made for, you know, film critics versus.
No, totally. So. Speaking of which, we didn't have like a post-Cannes show this year with anybody who went, so that's why I've got this question. How's the new Todd Haynes?
I like it very, very much. Do I love it? No, but I like it very, very much. I found myself incredibly moved by it. I think it's really interesting. I think he's at an interesting point in his career. And could you remind me of the name of the movie?
Wonderstruck?
Yes, Wonderstruck. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's based on a book. And I think, you know, one of the things that I know that he did with Carol, he was going to start working with material that he had not originated.
Right.
You know, and I think that that's really smart. I think one of the problems with kind of that happens to younger filmmakers, and sometimes it continues, is that people feel like they actually have to write and direct.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, not everyone is good at doing both, you right. know? And I think, you know, when you think about a classic, you know, the auteurs, the auteurs that were revered by Cahiers, a lot of those directors were not writing
sure,
you know,
yeah.
their own work at all. But I think at some point it became this kind of idea that to be a real auteur, you mm-hmm. had to write and direct, you know? And right. that's just silly. Some people, their strength is directing. I would say someone like David Fincher.
Yeah.
You know, brilliant director.
And there are, I think, writer-directors who I think, oh, God, I would love to see somebody else direct your great scripts.
Exactly.
Because you have no visual anything going on.
At
you
all.
Know? So, yeah, interesting. I guess how do you feel about the feedback for this, of the list? Do you
think it's been really encouraging because I think, you know, I would, like, just starting with the list, I think anything that you do that gets people to thinking about movies is freaking awesome, you know, like, and it's just a kind of like movies are really important. And, you know, I'm not interested in TV versus movies argument. It's like completely uninteresting to me because I know what the answer is. So I'm just really excited. And also if we can steer people to watching a Dardenne Brothers movie, if we can steer people to an Asias movie, if we can steer people, that's super exciting to me. You know, that's really, and, but I thought, you know, for the most part, I thought, I mean, I didn't get a lot of hate, you know, I felt that that was really, really positive sign. Right. I didn't get like, you stupid, you should die kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know? It wasn't Ghostbusters, let's put it that way. And I felt that there was something kind of wonderful about people were tapping into their own movie love, you know, and that's great. And then they were sharing it, and that's cool. That's really, really good. It's, I think it's been all positive.
You reminded me, as I read through the list, of films that I love so much that they just have become part of my life, and I sometimes forget to tell people about them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I feel like I've talked about them so much. Uh-huh. I don't want to, like, I think, okay, you should stop talking about The Gleaners and I because you talked about it too much. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I've talked about Summer Hours on this show a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you talked about it to a lot on the show. You showed it to your class at Chapman. And I, so there are moments, there were moments while
reading it. Spirited Away, I feel like, I gotta shut up about Spirited Away.
Like, it made me think, oh, I have to start talking to people about The Gleaners and I again, because I love that movie so much. And when it came out and I wrote about it, I couldn't stop talking about it to people, to the point, I think, where I made myself obnoxious.
And I know I failed.
And I, yeah, and I, because, you know, one of the things I always encountered, have always encountered, now I don't write for anyone now except The Wrap, and that's just twice a month, but when I was full-time at Movies.com or before that at iFilm, I would talk to other people whose jobs were to write about films, and they would say, well, so what are you seeing that you like? And I would say, The Gleaners and I. And here's this is not a made-up quote. No, I mean real movies.
Well,
yeah. And I'd be like, I'll kill you, you know.
But I think, you know, this is coming back to something that we had introduced earlier, is that, you know, I'm not against the major American studios, the big studios, not at all. Yeah. You know, they make some really good movies. They make some very terrible movies. They make a kind of a large percentage of them are just mediocre movies. But they don't make all the movies that are released in the world, though you wouldn't necessarily know it from how the mainstream media covers it.
Sure.
You know, and how many conversations, how many articles. I mean, I love Wonder Woman. I just want to put that out there. I love it. I want to talk about other movies, though. You know? I want to talk about other things beyond the super. I mean, I feel like we've been, like, kind of colonized by this discourse about just those movies. Yes. And I think, you know, if, again, one of the kind of functions of something like this, which, again, may just can be dismissed as clickbait, as it has been, is to kind of try to kind of work as a counter to that kind of colonization where the only thing we ever talk about are the big studio releases. You know, we need, these movies need a kind of mission, they need missionaries. They need people who are just out there talking about The Gleaners and I and movies of like that, art cinema, you know, that is not difficult necessarily cinema, that is very accessible.
No, yeah, it's not
absolutely
it's
accessible.
Not demand, these films aren't demanding, really. And I grew up hardcore evangelical, so that makes me pretty good at it, I guess. you know, my cause is, have you heard the good news about Agnes Varda? You know, like, it's that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Amen,
know,
brother.
Well, I think, you know, when we were talking earlier about how, like, you know, you, when it was considered, if you were an urban intellectual, of course you had to run out and see the new Truffaut or whatever. I think it's that thing where, like, people in this country used to, there was at least like a minimal amount of kind of cultural education, like, and there was a notion of like, yes, we're going to do opera on television because people feel like they need to see it. People are going to join the Book of the Month Club because they feel like they need to be on top of the latest novels to have conversations. And slowly that level of the culture has eroded. And I think part of what it took with it was that that foreign film audience.
Which doesn't mean that we don't talk about popular culture, you know? And I like, you know, I love writing about blockbusters. That's like an area where I really like it. I'm really interested in how blockbusters work. It's something that I'm very, you know, I love Christopher Nolan, and I'm not apologetic about it, you know? But I also really love Agnes Varda, if I'm doing it correctly. And I love all these other, and it's just very frustrating that you know, when we talk about movies in this country, we're often only talking about a very small set of movies.
Sure.
And we're talking about that set of movies a lot. I loved Get Out. I gave it a very positive review. I would very much like us to talk about our other movies. It becomes as part of this kind of news cycle.
Yes.
But again, and Get Out was actually a terrible example because that movie needed all the help, I think, you know, and then it just took off.
Right.
But it's really about, like, talking endlessly about superhero movies, comic book movies, the franchises, all the really, really big studio stuff. And they're, you know, they've become very, very good at making us care and, you know, and making us talk about it.
Right.
So I think we have to push back.
And you know, it does become this sort of cycle where it's like, I remember I saw a documentary about what killed radio, like what killed radio, basically. Uh-huh. Was this notion that it used to be that, like, individual stations would have their own charts and figure out what they wanted to do, but then they all started reporting their charts to Billboard, and then those Billboard charts became the playlist, and that's why every radio station plays the same songs and stuff. Yeah. You know,
that's
and
horrible.
So, like, when I look at that email that I get every day of who's clicking my stuff, invariably in the top five is going to be like my list of the ranked Marvel movies, mm-hmm, you know, my mm-hmm, list of mm-hmm. the ranked Star Wars movies, even when there's not a new one of those floating around. It's just like, that's what people are drawn to. And I'm sure I have bosses who see those kind of numbers and go, oh, well, more of this then.
Exactly right.
And so it's a
self-perpetuating.
Exactly.
Do you get numbers for every single thing?
Just for stuff, I get a listing every day of the of articles by me, the top 10 click getters that day.
Oh, okay. So you couldn't tell me how many people have read my review of The Woman Who Left?
I could not know. So maybe somebody at the Rap has access to that.
I want you to find out.
But again,
I'm thinking it's like 3 dozen.
And so that's why I'm pleasantly surprised when, like I said, when my Take Me to the River review keeps popping up. I'm like, okay, well then
that's
someone's.
Wonderful.
But that's so the exception.
So how do we break this? You know, that's a really
That's
difficult.
The question.
That
yeah.
is the question, and because, you know, I can't really blame any editor that says, well, yeah, you know, we're not getting a lot of traffic with the Law of Diaz reviews, so let's run another Marvel story, you
sure.
know, because we
oh,
know
great.
That that's going to get a lot of attention.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we can talk about, like, you know, noble intentions and this and that, but, you know, the fact is that these are not nonprofits.
But I think also there's the challenge of going back to what we were talking about earlier, making these movies not sound like broccoli.
Right, exactly. How do you get away? And if you have someone who's really smart and, you know, referring to, like, certain kinds of movies, like a Kelly Reichardt movie, for goodness sake, as, you mm-hmm. know, cultural vegetables, how we got into that whole, you know,
right.
boring.
Right.
That's a problem, you know? And again, I think this is part of, like, habit. It's about people becoming accustomed. Everyone's used to, like, you know, they start talking about Mad Men seriously. They started talking about HBO, you know, HBO shows seriously. How do you get people to, like, pay attention to movies in that same way? It's difficult.
There is.
And not just the pop movies, I just want to say.
Sure, no. Like, how did we get people to see Moonlight? Like, I'm still kind of mystified that happened.
I did, and yet, given how much press, how much attention that Moonlight got,
mm-hmm.
you know, its theatrical should have been even higher, I think. You know? Mm. I mean, it depends.
Yeah.
I remember.
For me, it's a black gay movie that anybody saw it at all.
No,
it's like
astonishing.
A miracle.
But you would think that it would be, you know, given the ratio of, like, how much attention it received.
No,
versus
absolutely.
It's still kind of like,
yeah.
It was like the Hurt Locker, same thing. You
True.
Know, you would, it's like you had Hurt Locker coming out of your ears.
And they're probably, like, the two lowest grossing Best Picture winners.
I believe that they actually are.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
When Anna was a teenager, our niece, our niece Anna. She came to visit us. She spent, gosh, it was like a week or so, or a weekend, I can't remember now. She was still in high school.
Mm.
And so she went with me to screenings.
Oh, I remember this.
And I took her to a screening of, I'm going to butcher the name, Pen Ek Ratanarung, Last Life in the Universe. Took her to a screening of that. She'd never seen anything like that before.
Mm-hmm.
Thai film. Like, not, you know, she lives in Tacoma. And
not that people in Tacoma don't.
Not that people in Tacoma don't go see
interesting foreign films,
but they don't get probably as much theatrical opportunities. Choice.
Access, yeah. As we discussed, access, and you're 15.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
you're going to run out to the Thai movie if someone's going to like drag you to it. Mm-hmm. We walked out of the movie, and she said, "I liked that. I think
awesome."
She said, "I don't know what I watched."
Also,
and I said, "That doesn't matter." Mm-hmm. I said, "You liked it, then that's cool, right? You, here are some other, you know, Asian filmmakers perhaps you would enjoy."
That is very groovy.
And I said, "It doesn't even matter that you didn't like it, because have you ever seen a movie like this before?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, okay, there are different ways of making films that don't always involve a narrative that goes, you know, A, B, C, D, E. And there are different ways of watching films that require you to be a different... use your eyes and ears a little differently than when you are watching, you know, whatever, some mainstream Hollywood film." And it's like working out. Something I never do, but it's what you...
I think.
I understand. People tell me that if you push the weight up once, it's hard, and then you do it again, and it's a little less hard. You know, it's like, go see another movie like this.
Become accustomed to it. Don't, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
make yourself accustomed to this kind of thing, and you won't feel alienated. You won't feel condescended to. You won't feel like the filmmaker is intentionally trying to confuse you because he thinks he's smarter than you are. You know, it's none of these things are true. None of it's real. It's stuff people make up in their head to keep themselves distanced from the thing that frightens them. And so, keep going.
It's like when
and
you...
And that is, that's, I think, as a film critics, I think, are people who should also be encouragers of...
Yes.
Hey, yes, this is a film about a young woman who's very poor, and she loses her dog, and it's incredibly sad, and no one talks very much, and it moves quietly, and there's... just sit with it, please.
Right.
For a moment. And then if this is the first kind of thing, first kind of film you've seen like this, do it again. If you think maybe you felt something, then go back and do it again with a different filmmaker or another film by the same filmmaker.
It's like if you encounter adults who don't eat anything more challenging than Olive Garden, and you're like, try the arugula. Like the first bite, you may not love it, but like expand the palate. Yeah, eventually you'll come to realize how great it is.
There is on the list is. White Material from Claire Denis, who, along with Ho Xiao Shen and A Pitch Up on Where Is Ethical, these are my three favorite living people who make movies, okay? And I saw that White Material was on the list, and I thought, I like The Intruder better. And I like The Intruder better, and this I had this whole thought process with myself. Because the first time I saw it, I said, when it was over, what? And I went back the week it opened, I wrote the review, and then it opened, and I went back again, and I wish I'd had that time to sit with it and live with it for a minute, because it got in me, and... freaked me out and made me upset and made me unhappy, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I went again when it opened at the New Art, and the second time I thought, okay, alright. There, I started to be able to draw a connection from it to something like Beau Travail, which I had seen, you know, however many years earlier, and I would call a film like The Intruder demanding. I would call that demanding. Mm-hmm. It demanded something of me, mm-hmm. because the first time I watched it, I thought, I don't know I just don't know what's happening. And then there'll be a film like going back to The Gleaners and I, or the Woman Who Left, not demanding films in terms of their narrative, in terms of, you know, what you can get from watching it one time.
But demanding, you know, perhaps in other ways.
Demanding perhaps in other ways, mm-hmm. but not the kind of vegetables, homework, the words we associate with that kind of thing.
But I don't think work is necessarily a bad
thing. It is not a bad thing.
See, there we are.
It is not a bad thing at all.
It's stimulating.
There's a difference.
It can be stimulating.
Thinking is stimulating.
There's so much out there in the world, in this world of film, the kind we're talking about, the smaller films, the foreign language stuff, that just because it fits into the camp of tiny little movie, foreign country, right, subtitles, doesn't mean it's demanding.
No, you know, not at all.
Sometimes it will be, but that doesn't mean it naturally is going to be.
Movies put out by old Miramax films that makes that makes that point nicely.
No, I had the same thing with the list where there were a lot of people who are like, okay, I Coen Brothers, yes, I'd have gone Serious Man instead of Inside Llewyn Davis, or like Pixar, yes, I'd have gone Toy Story 3 instead of Inside Out, but you know. They're all like, yes, these are people doing interesting work, and these are people who should be represented on a list like this. I'll never understand your Clint Eastwood thing, but that's just us.
Yeah, it's funny. We've talked a lot about that because I think that was the one that we were both most surprised about the pushback. You know, but I think part of that is just generational. You know, part of it. I mean, I am.
You're my age, though. You're a little younger. But.
No, I think I'm older than you. I don't want to talk.
We'll talk off mic. Okay.
But I think it's just like there are people who are Eastwood partisans and there are people who are not, and we are both very, very. And I have been my entire life. You know, I'm a very, and I love that movie passionately. I mean, I do, and it's just, and I love Eastwood so.
I will say thank you for not picking Jersey Boys.
Okay, that would have been a moment. That would have been beyond. it's interesting. I think there are things that, I mean, one of the problems, let's say, again, with the kind of the dominance of, let's say, certain kinds of big studio movies. And again, I like some of them. I have given them very good reviews.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not about that. It's about how I think, like, certain kind of movies are very simple in terms of, like, we get used to their patterning, you know, their patterns,
sure.
and this is, we all expect that, like, this is what's going to happen, and then this is what's going to happen, and then this is going to happen, and at the end there's going to be, we're going to be cutting between three different areas of action as the hero does this, and then, you know, you're cutting, right, cutting back and forth. And we understand
the plan will fail, but then it will actually succeed,
right,
as it turns
right
out.
And, you know, and I sometimes will sit there and count, like, I'm really interested in, like, Fast Furious, how many movies, how many different areas of action it can kind of weave together until it's incoherent, you know, like, it's super interesting. But I think, you know, the patterns in other movies are different patterns, and you have to get used to the pattern in a Lav Diaz movie, and it may not reveal itself to you right away. And so you have to just kind of go with it, and you have to go. And the Claire Denis, you know, her work is sometimes we're in a kind of flurry of images, you know, and they're kind of, but if you actually just sit there, you can start to put them together, and meaning will come through, and it's very pleasurable.
Mm-hmm. I've talked about, like, the great bad movies, like The Room, in this way, but it also obviously applies to the great movies as well, which is when you're watching a movie where, those rules that we've become accustomed to and those patterns that we've become accustomed to are not on the table
at all.
You suddenly, you're just like, your ears go up and like, okay, I gotta see where this is going to take me and go where it's going to go. And, you know, I remember one of the most exciting moments for me as a moviegoer was, did you ever see an Adam Egoyan movie called The Adjuster?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That was a movie where I literally, like, what happens in the last 2 minutes of that movie made me completely reevaluate every other thing that had happened. And it was so exciting. That had never happened before in a movie. And it just, like, blew my mind. And so, yeah, when a movie can make it, you know, it, like a virgin touched for the very first time, you know, when it can have that effect on you, it's exciting.
No, it is. You know, these are not necessarily movies that you can sit and scroll through your Twitter feed watching. I mean, they demand attention, not distraction.
Yes.
They demand certain things from you. And again, like with Love, Diaz, it's not necessarily difficult. They demand time.
Right.
It's a long movie. The most recent one is a long, it's like five, is it four and a half?
It's three and...
I thought it was over three.
It's 3 hours and 40, 3 hours and 40 minutes.
I think it's a short one for him. So, you know, but it, yeah. So it demands other things, but, yeah. You know, and it, so it demands your time.
Yeah.
It demands that you just think, not like, again, check your social media, you know, like it demands
right. Your
attention.
Bladder. You gotta put that thing away.
You need to have emptied your bladder before entering the theater. you know, but it will reward you in other ways.
Or, you know, you can get up and go to the bathroom while there's a scene where she's just sitting there for 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. When she's in the house, yeah, that's fine.
You can go to the bathroom. It's fine.
Yeah, it's actually fine. And probably a good idea for your health.
is there one movie that you're like, hey, that it's not on this list?
That it's not on the
list? Oh, I'm sure there are many, but that's okay. This is just our list.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to throw out,
I just
like,
said, earlier I said one of my top three favorite people is A Pitch Up On.
Oh, that's true.
And there's nothing on here. And... But that doesn't mean anything.
No,
really.
I'm not trying because to negate anything. I just thought it'd be interesting if we each sort of.
Oh, and that's okay if you did. I don't care if people agree with me ever. You know, I mean, I think as a movie critic, you have to do that because you're just putting your opinions out. And it's like, this is my opinion.
Yeah.
You don't have to agree. And so I'm always so interested in the violent. You know, I'm like, it's just one person's opinion.
I'm girding myself for disliking a movie coming out very soon that everybody loves. So, you know, we'll talk about that next week.
Oh, okay.
You just gave it away.
Yes. But for me, if I was one, I was like, Synecdoche, New York.
Which movie I gave a very, very good review of, and I believe put on my top 10, I do not believe was in consideration because we would have to both agree on it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
So, okay. You know, I mean, again, this is a list that was put together by two different people,
sure.
And we had to find points of connection. And as I said, Zodiac's not on this. Right. If it had been up to me, it would have been on the list. So.
Dave White likes to bitch every year about how LA Film Critics makes these tame choices, and, you know, we don't, da 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 da. But again, it's like, you think two people making a choice is hard.
Because I'm not a member, and I just get to sit home and collect with screeners.
For all the compromises that Manola had to make just working with one other person,
yes.
Then you get a room full of 40 people.
Yes.
Do the math. It's that much more difficult to find that common ground.
Right, and I didn't... Like,
your people
I
continue to disappoint me.
I just want to say, like, you know, yes, there were compromises made, but I still, like, I embrace the list.
You stand behind
it. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because I couldn't sign my name to something that I was like, oh, I'm holding my nose. It wasn't like voting. Sorry.
Well, I mean, that is the thing with LAFCA is that the majority does take sway, whereas here this was a compromise where it was a consensus, you know. We should talk about this week's movies, I suppose.
Why don't you tell us all about Trans 5 Mers, Alonzo? Sorry, Trans 5 Mers.
That bad.
Oh, God. Okay, maybe not as bad as 2 and 3, but still, I just find these movies just dead. Like, the opposite of everything we've been talking about for the last hour, as far as, like, there's nothing exciting about them. They are not visually coherent. I've had the people accuse me, it's giant robots fighting. What more do you want? I want to see giant robots fighting in a way where I can perceive where one robot ends and the other one begins. You know, I want to see a robot fist connect with a robot jaw. I don't want to see this swirl of pixels where I have no idea what's going on.
Is it still a kind of, I always see those movies as basically commercials for the military industrial complex. Is it still?
There are a lot of gleaming shots of, you know, was it Brian Williams quoting Leonard Cohen? Our awesome weapons or whatever, you know, a lot of tanks and planes and aircraft carriers. But the funny thing is, I was noticing in this one that, like, as much as he loves to show the hardware and to show, like, the troops in formation and all that stuff, the actual decisions made by the military are rock stupid. Like, in this movie, there's this staff that everybody's trying to get that the original Transformers gave in the 10th century to Merlin.
Oh my God.
Oh yes, played by Stanley Tucci again. And so the Army's big idea is, okay, we're going to let Megatron out of prison, and we're going to let Megatron put together like a dirty dozen of other psychotic robots, and then they'll get the staff, but then we'll take it from him. It's like, this is how we got into Vietnam, people. Come on, you know.
But without robots. Sorry.
Without robots, yeah. It's sort of incredibly stupid decision making on the amount of on the part of the military. But of course, but no, just look again at how great these tanks look.
But why not just dispense with story altogether. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and just say, you know what? You just want to see stuff blow up and people,
yeah,
you know,
to
like
the chase.
Just have it be like non-stuff blowing out and punching.
Well, this between that,
give up the idea.
This sounds immensely pleasurable.
But
it's an avant-garde movie.
Between the punching and the exploding, we get Anthony Hopkins giving tons of exposition. You know, with this like secret society that has existed for generations or for millennia or something. And but to hear Anthony Hopkins say, Megatron is hysterical.
I almost went to see it this week so that I could talk about it here. And then I thought, I don't have to see it to talk about it.
Nope.
Because I've seen the first four.
Yeah
you know what you're in for.
And I know what I'm in for. Now,
you are in for what you're in for.
I'm going to preface this by saying, I'm going to go see this movie. But I'm going to go in the way that will give me the maximum pleasure, and that will be in about 10 days.
Okay.
At like 10 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday when I'm alone.
Grape soda.
And it's like, it's already 90 degrees. Like, I'll be in a very chilled room alone watching this idiotic movie. I like the Transformers movies for all the reasons that they are hated.
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking recently about a better way to explain why. And I think I've come up with what it is.
Does it involve the name Norman McLaren?
It involves Merzbau.
Okay, bring it.
Okay, so about 10 years ago, the magazine Arthur had a music festival.
Mm.
And Sonic Youth were the headliners with Yoko Ono. And so I went, because I love them both.
Yeah.
And but the afternoon leading up to the headliners was, it was at the Frank Lloyd Wright, it was at Barnsdale.
Oh.
Inside, so it was a hot summer day, but we were all inside. And the afternoon was dominated by extreme noise.
And everyone there was 50, right?
No.
Okay.
No. I was 43. it was Merzbau. And the Finnish prog metal band Circle and Magic Markers, who are a guitar duo who are just chaos. And who else? Oh, Sun. This drone doom metal band.
Part of why we're still together is that he doesn't make me go with him.
So Merzbau, specifically, is a Japanese guy who does just extremely punishing electronic noise. That you must wear protective stuff to endure it. They aren't songs. It's an hour. It's an hour of, you know, and shifting frequencies and you know, even with earplugs, people are walking out. And that kind of musical chaos is very appealing to me. I couldn't always tell you structurally what's happening. But I feel like I'm being pummeled in a very sensual way.
I know where we're going here.
and that's pleasurable for me. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm watching the Transformers films, I feel like I'm being pummeled in a way that is maybe not fully competent, but it's still a pummeling. Mm-hmm. And I like that. And so I'm not ever giving them up. Like, they could keep making them, and I'll keep going, but I'm not gonna do it. There's no reason for me to talk about it. And this week on Twitter, the critic Miriam Bale tweeted, "Why bother writing reviews for this movie? Why don't you go spend your time watching something else and encourage people to watch that thing?" Like, why don't you do that?
It's my job.
Unless you have something important to say. Not counting the people who have to do it. Unless you have something important to say about this film. And I personally, Dave White, I have nothing important to say about these films other than like it. And so I decided to take her advice. She has no idea who I am, but I decided to take her advice. I went to Mount Unwatched. In the closet, we have a stack of DVDs and Blu-rays mm-hmm. that we're going to get to.
Eventually.
Yeah. And I pulled this off the stack The Magic Box, the Shirley Clark collection, 3 DVD thing. Mm-hmm. I put it on the stack. I was like, I'm going to get to that. And this was almost a year ago.
Right, I thought our Blu-ray player was broken.
No, we have the portable.
Oh.
We have the portable.
Gotcha.
And so I watched the Brussels Loops that she and D.A. Pennebaker made for the 1958 Brussels World's Fair.
That's great.
About American life. And it was so just intoxicatingly beautiful. And he came home and I said, you have not gotten to this on Mount Unwatched yet either. And it's going to make you so happy. It is really going to make you so happy.
Yeah, footage of people in grocery stores, I'm
in. 1957? Yes, this is perfect.
I live for that stuff.
And so you guys, go see Transformers if you want, but also drop $50, because that's how much it costs on Amazon, or go to the library, and hopefully maybe they have it. But the Shirley Clark 3-disc set is, your life will be happier. You'll be a happier person watching these films. One disc is all, they call it experimental. I guess it is. But it's just really fun stuff to look at. And there's a disc of all dance, because she was a dancer. And then a disc of some other stuff that she did, an Oscar-winning documentary she made about Robert Frost.
All right, I want to throw out one last thing about Transformers, then we can move on. Manolo, I think you were an early adopter in the Michael Bay is an auteur of sorts movement that other people have leapt onto.
Yes, I am.
The thing with that is, like, I mean, okay, sure.
In terms of, like, there is, it's a visual, not a qualitative, you know, I'm not making an argument for him. I'm just saying he's an auteur by any definition of what we consider an auteur. Is like, he has a worldview, a consistent worldview. He has visual signatures. You know, he's what we might call his mise-en-scene, you know, there's a certain, but, you know, I look at that and I get it, and, you know, and I absolutely, now, he's a disreputable one, he's one that is not loved, he's not one that I particularly like, but trying to understand Michael Bay was really interesting to me, and so I did review a couple of the early Transformers films, but then I kind of, like, I figured him out for myself, at least, and right. I didn't need to see that
man. We're done. I just find him so toxic in terms of, like, the men in his movies, the moment they get angry, turn into, like, 12-year-old boys with you know, like, rage issues.
And who better to cast in that role than Markety Mark?
Yeah, exactly. In another movie where he gets to be the only person who can save the day and the only person who's been right about everything all along, you guys.
It's the third nipple.
Yeah, exactly. It sees things. There's literally a scene where he says that he was the only one who was right about blah, blah, blah all the time, and all these military guys, like, rip their patches off and throw them to the floor. God bless you, Marky
Mark. Okay, can I say, like, now I really feel like I need to go with Dave to see this movie.
Also,
I'll be at the Grove at, like, 10 a.m. on a Wednesday.
The main woman in the movie is an Oxford professor with 3 degrees. Can you guess how she dresses?
Does she wear glasses?
And shockingly, no.
Oh, I'm surprised.
She does, however, like, never leave the house without a push-up bra on, and the cinematographer's right up there in it.
Who doesn't?
I don't. Sir.
My PhD is up here.
Totally, yes.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, moving on. The two very interesting indies opening this week. First of all, there's Sofia Coppola's Cannes award-winning The Beguiled.
Yes.
Which is a... I keep getting into arguments with people. I'm not calling it a remake of the 1971 Don Siegel movie. They are both based on the same novel. And I think
that's fair.
I think that's fair. I think in this case it's fair because I think she's really taking a very different... Absolutely. Slant on it.
Absolutely.
The basic premise is that it's toward the end of the Civil War. It's a girls' school in Virginia. One of the young ladies goes into the forest one day and stumbles upon an injured Union soldier, brings him back, and a man in the house sort of sets off any number of distractions and complications and unearths sort of buried emotions. I love this movie, and I'm not always Team Coppola, but I really thought this worked. And then going back and watching the first one on HBO Go, I think she has a better handle on the material in a lot of ways. Because there's so much that she allows, I thought, that she allows the audience to infer that Siegel has them say to themselves in voiceover, you know, that's like, oh, come on, you know. But again, I know it was 1971, things were different, but I don't know. I think there's a lot of stuff that she does better about it. And I think that she makes the motivations not always as clear, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, that's just me.
Dave, I know you really liked it.
Well, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Also, though, I think I like the original one quite a bit as well. Maybe more than you.
I'm on Team Siegel. What can I say?
I mean, there are things I like about the original one, don't get me wrong. And if I'd seen it out of context,
the filmmaking, for one. I'm sorry.
Specifically how, though?
Okay.
No, I mean, I there's a lot of things that I really love about the first one. I think it's crazy. I think it's demented. I think it's also sexist, but it's more interesting than it is sexist, so it's more interesting. Like, I can hold on to that, because if I have to worry about sexism in a movies, I would just
You'll never leave a house.
I would never leave the house. I would never become a movie critic. I mean, I see the first one as very much a reaction to second wave feminism. You know, it's a kind of a it's like a hysterical movie, a kind of male hysterical
nightmare scenario.
Right, exactly. About like what women are capable of, particularly
in control.
When they're like left, you know, they're in this small, it's like, to me, they're like some sort of sisterhood kind of like encounter group, you know, they're a metaphor. And he kind of, it's like, what are they going to do? They're going to castrate you, if not physically, literally, you know, certainly symbolically. So to me, it's a male hysteria movie. And I find that really interesting. I also really like the filmmaking. I think that there's a lot of things that are just super interesting. There's one amazing scene of Siegel, I'm sorry, of in which the very young pompadoured Eastwood is thinking about the various women that he's bedded at that point in the movie. And this is very different, again, from Coppola. So I'm not giving anything away about the Coppola, because this is not what happens. And the camera, there's a pan right, and then there's a series of, I think it's three different flashbacks that kind of are one after another of him kissing the various women.
Yeah.
And, you know, very lusty, deep kisses. And then the camera then pans left back to Eastwood's very satisfied face, and it's really fun, overheated, kind of wild expressionistic filmmaking. And so I really, really respond to that. I really try to be very open minded, as always, with Coppola's work, and I'm not a fan. For me, this movie, I don't actually even know what this movie is about. I just, you know, things happen, and it's very dark. And one of my biggest irritations with the movie is that it's too dark, actually. And I love a dark movie. I love film noir. I think you should be able to actually see the actors' faces very clearly.
Oh, wow. I didn't
know
that.
Huh. I don't know. I just didn't. So I don't know what the movie is supposed to. I don't really understand what she thinks she's doing. And I feel it's very kind of like, okay.
This was my takeaway. I'm not mansplaining, because I could be totally wrong.
No. And also, let's just drop that term.
Okay.
You guys are my friends, and we're having a conversation.
To me, it read as a story about survival, and about women surviving in both a period in which sort of the men were obviously, you know, there was a patriarchy, and they were denied agency, but in a war, which is in itself arguably like the most masculine of pursuits, that they were able to, you know, how they were able to keep themselves alive and buttress themselves from the outside world, and how this intruder from that world, ultimately they were able to contend with in a way that allowed them to continue.
And I think that's a very reasonable reading. It's just not interestingly done for me, I guess.
Okay.
You know, I didn't respond to it. And I would also, like, very honestly, yes, I think there's, you know, we don't watch movies in isolation, and it's impossible for me to watch that movie not also referring in my head to the Don Siegel.
Sure,
that movie I really like, and I think it's much better, and I'm just, you know, it just didn't work for me.
No, and I'm sure, like I said, my take on the Siegel film probably would have been different had I not seen this other one first. You
know?
It's always
who
that.
Knows, right?
It's that first, the one that imprints on you, you know.
I think that's fair, you know, we're human beings.
So I did a bang bang.
That's true, yeah, you did it the same day.
I watched the first one, the original one in the morning on HBO Go. I'd never seen it.
Uh-huh.
And then I bought a ticket to the ArcLight and
That's awesome.
Saw the Coppola. The original is so hot and sweaty.
It's
and
just humping your leg the entire time.
And within the first 5 minutes, Clint Eastwood is kissing 12-year-old Pamela Ferdinand on the lips.
On the mouth.
And he's like, old enough for kisses. And it's like, oh my God! What's happening already?
She's just said, like, I'm 12, I'm almost 13. Old enough for kisses.
It is such a dirty movie, I have to say.
And so then...
And the revelations about other characters later, like,
oh my God! I mean, Nicole Kidman does a lot with very little, really. She's not given very much. Whereas Geraldine Page had, like, so much to work with.
Yeah, like beyond Tennessee Williams level.
Wow.
Of,
it almost plays like a parody of Tennessee Williams at some point.
True.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Here's the thing that I like about both films.
Have you read Tennessee Williams with Air Conditioning in the New Yorker?
Oh, God.
No, I'm waiting. Yes.
You guys, the New Yorker has a piece this week called Tennessee Williams with Air Conditioning. You will laugh. It is very funny.
I'm sure it changes everything.
Yes.
Stanley's t-shirt is no longer wet. Yeah,
no one is wet. Only the beautiful iced tea in their glasses that satisfies them without alcohol in it. Yeah. Okay, so, as I referenced earlier, and pretty much on every episode of Linoleum Knife since it's our inception, I grew up really hardcore evangelical, you guys. Conservative, fundamentalist Christian. All right. There's a thing in the Bible, in the Old Testament, about hospitality.
Yes, that's the sin of Sodom.
And the sin of Sodom was that they did not show hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. It wasn't me. It was the hospitality.
It's not about the butt being for love reasons.
Not about the butt being for love reasons. It's about hospitality. So, here's one of the things that I think is so really cool and crazy about the first one. The repeated references to biblical stuff. One of the girls is singing the hymn in the garden.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. There's a painting that gets reenacted in a sexual way, a religious painting that is reenacted in a sexual way in Geraldine Page's
fevered imagination.
Fevered mind.
Such a great performance.
She was younger making that movie than Kidman is now.
I know, and their casting says a lot about contemporary.
That's why the actresses in Feud were actually decades older than Davis and Crawford.
Yeah. And they take it all the way in the first one where Geraldine Page, this is a spoiler, who cares? It's not going to affect your enjoyment of this wild movie.
I don't know if you can spoil a movie that's 45 years old, but go ahead.
She was incestuously involved with her own brother.
Yes.
And she fantasizes about him, and she puts Clint Eastwood into that fantasy as his substitute. Well, y'all, I don't know if you've read the Old Testament lately, but everybody was having sex with their own siblings back then.
It's true. Or
and
parents.
And it was okay. Like, it was like, I want you to go impregnate your daughter to make sure the line continues. Go and
who do they keep getting drunk in the cave?
Seduce your father. So it was that element of it. It ties up with this Southern Christian thing, and the idea of Southern hospitality comes into play as well as a rule that must be enforced. And so then you get to this new one, and no one's sweating. They say it's the South, and you know it is because it's the same building where Beyonce shot Lemonade.
Well, okay, I will say that there was. I just want to throw in real quick.
Yes,
I like the fact there's almost no music in the movie, but those cicadas never stop humming.
There's very brief sort of hints of a score in three scenes from Coppola's husband,
Phoenix,
the guy from Phoenix, or it may be the band Phoenix doing the score. Anyway, nobody's sweating. It's all very chilled. And you're right, it is very dark in a way that makes it sometimes difficult to tell the girls apart.
I
didn't have this issue.
Yeah, I did. I really did. Yeah.
And what I feel Sofia Coppola working with here is her love of Kirsten Dunst and her admiration of Nicole Kidman, because both of those women are capable of serving a look that stops the scene, mm-hmm. redirects your attention, and makes you think entirely differently about what just happened.
Nicole Kidman serves a lot of face in this
movie. Nicole Kidman has at least three moments where the face is... The queens on RuPaul's Drag Race wish they could do this.
Yep.
Okay, so this is an entirely different film than the single
one. It is,
one.
Yeah.
And but it is a continuing, I think, Sofia Coppola's idea, which has been her idea from the start of
women
in a box and. And what will they do with themselves in that box? Mm-hmm. And this one in particular, very much like in Marie Antoinette, there's this festering thing happening out in the world that is going to come get them eventually. But they are in the prison of their own privilege. And they will do what they have to do to keep it that way. There's very little... It's only the sexuality in the Coppola one is kind of just sort of hinted at from time
to
time.
Yeah, it's barely.
What is Elle Fanning?
It is all in Elle Fanning's unkempt hair.
Yes.
That one strand of hair down her face, that's how you know.
Elle Fanning's face does not change, but her hair gets a little messier.
It does get a little messy.
Yeah. And you don't see anything happening with Kirsten Dunst until... You know, they confess their love for each other. Mm-hmm. So I liked this. I liked this quite a bit. I'm a fan of Sofia Coppola. Marie Antoinette is my favorite of the three. Not the three, but of her films. Yeah. But I like how she puts her women in the box and then makes them figure it out for themselves or not, or they just don't.
Or they don't. Right.
Yeah. And so, I like it.
She's an auteur.
The Seagull is just bonkers. And the touching on the criticism that I've been hearing earlier in the week, Ingu's article.
Yes.
About race.
Ingu Kang and Ira Madison III have both written interesting pieces about how Sofia Coppola treats race in general and how it's specifically
the removal of the slave character from this one.
And apparently both movies erase a racial aspect of another character.
Oh, really?
I learned.
Oh, from the novel?
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I mean, because in the Seagull one, there is an enslaved woman there who is actually very much part of the household.
Yes.
And at one point, Clint Eastwood she's very beautiful, and Clint Eastwood also is trying to come on to her. What's that Pasolini movie?
Oh, Teorema.
Teorema. I was just thinking about movies in which like a character comes in and seduces the whole.
Voodoo saved from drowning and yeah, something you
know,
for everyone.
Right,
and,
you know, yeah. comes. Yeah. That's an interesting kind of idea.
Trope.
Right, trope that someone comes in and kind of like a virus infects the whole household.
Yes.
You know, this kind of sexual energy and
they either all succumb or they all gang up and kill. The
right,
person.
Exactly, exactly.
Choices.
Or both.
Yeah.
So I think which. Coppola, I think, didn't want to deal with race, and so she just removes that character, which is, I think, a mistake, because you have a movie set in the Civil War in the South with no...
Well, they say early on, the slaves left. Like, that's
her
excuse.
Yeah, but the idea, like, the slaves left, it's like they didn't have the idea of agency, just, like the idea of dropping... No, but suggesting agency with enslaved people just kind of...
No, it's not like we let them go. I think it's like the war started and we were unable to stop them because we were a bunch of women with one gun.
But it's just such a weird... It's just such a, like, I think for me, she's very elliptical, she's very oblique, and this isn't a case where I feel like you really need to deal with race as opposed to, like, I don't know what to do, so I'm not going to deal with race.
I don't know.
I thought that was a mistake.
I think it was a thankless situation for her to be in because there were a million ways that she would have gotten it wrong or it would have been perceived that she'd gotten
it
wrong.
But white filmmakers need to get it wrong so that they can stop, like, eliding race. I mean, I really do. I just feel like it is... You know, I know she's in this difficult position where she's probably going to be criticized, or she might or might not, if she actually kind of works hard at it. You know, like, but that's a real challenge that needs to be met, as opposed to just like, I don't know how to deal with race, so I'm not going to deal with it, even though this is a Civil War movie. And one of them, and there was a, you know, a made kind of important black character in the first movie. I don't know. I just feel like I'd much prefer white filmmakers to stumble and to just suck it up with criticism and try to keep getting it right.
You get the ugly power dynamic in the original film. And having that character.
She's the only character who I think you see naked, right? Or no, you don't. You see another one.
Yeah, there's a couple,
but he rips open her shirt. Well, no, really shocking.
There's a flashback to Geraldine Page's brother
raping her too.
No,
right?
Trying to rape her, but she holds up the pitchfork and stops it.
Right. Yeah. Which is amazing because it shows, you know,
agency.
It also shows the kind of sexual domination and actual, you know, attempted and often rape of enslaved women, which I think is really important. Like, just in terms of, like, I think it enriches the movie as well, just in basic story terms, you know? So
I empathize with her just because I feel like, I mean, obviously part of the problem, and I hadn't really, to be honest, I didn't know this much about it, but these already, the Ira and the Ingu pieces both talk about how, like, you know, yeah, if you watch Lost in Translation, it's super racist with the way it treats Asian characters. The Bling Ring, like, leaves out an entire, like, Hispanic character who was major to the real-life story. So it's like...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. So, like, she has this kind of checkered history with that, and so it's sort of like, okay, either I don't make this 1860s movie, or I make it without the slave character, or her excuse was, I didn't want young black women to see that character... in a film, which...
that's not a good... I mean, I think...
I don't think that's a good reason.
I think there's another choice. You work harder. I mean, I just think, like, in terms of representation, you just have to work harder. I feel the same way... I'm a white woman. I think that's... I mean, just letting it... But I feel the same way about, like, these movies in which, you know, women are completely erased. You know, there are other ways to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes... One of the reasons, like, I really liked The Lost City of Z... I know this seems like a strange thing, but one of the reasons I really liked the Lost City of Z, the James Gray movie, mm-hmm. is that it was telling us a story that, yes, the main character is a white male explorer, but it pays a lot of attention to the woman and the family that he leaves behind.
Mm.
She doesn't just wave goodbye and you never see her till the very end of the movie.
Right.
She is integrated into the narrative of the movie. There are other ways. So it's a real attempt to, like, how do you tell a story of a white male explorer that doesn't reproduce the same kind of, you know, problems of representation?
Right.
There you have to work a little harder. I think Coppola could have worked a little harder if it was of interest to her. It was clearly not of interest to her.
All right. Well, another thing that one of those articles brought up was the famous, you know, where she asked, is it Elizabeth Fraser who wrote the book, the Marie Antoinette book that she was working from?
Oh gosh, I just looked that up.
Anyway,
Antonia Fraser.
She asked Antonia Fraser, "Would it be okay if I left out the politics?" And Antonia Fraser responded, "I think Marie would have appreciated that."
That is such a great line.
You know, and that was the movie that drew some. That somebody said, "Yeah, one day Sofia Coppola is going to make a movie about Uday Hussein shopping for shoes at Ferragamo."
I think that there is. I think that she should have included the slave character, only because it would have made it a more complicated story.
Yes, sure. That's actually a really good just. Formal argument, right?
The idea that she would muck up that character, I don't know. I trust her, you know, to at least come down on the side of slavery was bad
y'all.
and again, at the least. And so I think that
I saw the movie not knowing that character was originally in there. So
what I see in this film is very similar to what I see in other films. I think she was very committed to the one idea.
I think that's a good point.
And that, I'm guessing that in Sofia Coppola's mind, that supersedes everything else.
Mm.
You know, the reason she asks Antonia Fraser, "What if I left out the politics?" is probably the same reason why she thinks, "Okay, I'm going to take the slave character out because I want to deal with their interior lives and whatever else in the world that they are a part of." You know, the for me in this moment as a filmmaker, I just want to focus on this one thing. Now, if she had included that slave character in the film, then she would have had to deal with, like I say, something much more complicated, and that would be the complicity of
the other women
in the South who were on plantations who
were benefiting from slavery. Who were benefiting from slavery. Absolutely.
Exactly. And so
you're implicating white women in a barbaric institution.
Exactly.
And well, you should, because it wasn't just about pretty dresses. Yeah. You know, it just wasn't.
And so I feel like,
but also, if her interest is the women in the box, a slave woman is in a box for a different reason,
exactly,
and under different cultural circumstances than the other Coppola heroines.
I believe that it was a bad move to take out the slave character. But like, you went in not knowing that there had ever been a slave character.
You didn't like the movie. Yeah, no, that's fair. You know, I just like, I think it might have been a more interesting movie though. Yeah. She'd put
absolutely.
Her,
if
no
you
question.
Didn't ever know that, then you would see it, I think, as in the way that she wanted you to see it.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll tell y'all off mic, the deletion that both films make, you know, but it's like, again, that's a thing where like, that would have been more interesting, mm-hmm, but they didn't mm-hmm. want to go there. And
right.
So, you know.
I mean, the interesting thing about like living in a box, so you want to do these women living in the box, and they do, but you know, we live in boxes, let's say our heads are a box, you mm-hmm. know, but we do live in the world,
yeah.
You know, and the social is something that, like, it's almost as if she retreats from it, you know? And I think you can't fully. You're still living in the world. You live with other people. You know?
This is my theory. I think I've stated on the show before that I feel like, as the daughter of this globetrotting, internationally famous director, that she spent a lot of her childhood hidden away in hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the very first movie she ever wrote was that, said, the Life Without Zoe segment of New York.
Good
stories.
Hotel rooms, too.
Oh, yeah, the best hotel rooms.
Yeah.
Which is
with
like
nice terraces, I bet, that would look over the world.
Exactly, yeah. But like, so, you know, so she, you know, that was like a total Eloise story. So I
didn't she participate
yes.
somehow
she
in
wrote
that,
that. She co-wrote that
she
New York
yeah,
story
yeah.
segment
yeah.
So I feel I could, this could be massively reductive on my part, but I kind of feel like that she is interested in the story.
She's not here, let's talk about her.
Why not? I think she's interested in the story of these sort of the kind of women in these sort of gilded cages, in a way, you know, literal hotels in the sense of like, you know, somewhere, or you know, Versailles and mm-hmm. for Marie Antoinette or whatever. You know, in the same way that I think the first couple of Duncan Jones films were, you know, both Moon and
yes.
Source Code are about people who are kind of trapped in these very limited places. And I imagine him also being stuck in a lot of hotel rooms as a small child, you know. I don't know. I think there might be something there.
And that's an interesting thing. I just, you know, I want more, I guess.
Fair
you
enough.
Know? I think that she's obviously talented. I just want more.
Now, a movie you liked a great deal is The Big Sick, which also opens this weekend in limited release.
Mm-hmm.
An autobiographical romantic comedy.
Yes. you know, one of the things that is most interesting to me, but perhaps nobody else, but I'm nonetheless talk about it, is that here's a movie that is a very kind of visually very plain movie. You know,
mm-hmm.
I kind of really, and I wrote this, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but you know, the director, Michael
Showalter.
Not, I said, not much of a visual stylist.
No,
that is correct.
And yet, you know, it's a nicely put together movie. I think it's very well written, and it has so much heart. And one of the things that he's very good, and he was very good in Hello, My Name is Doris, his previous movie, is that he's very good as a director of making you see each character. You know, so even secondary characters for me really do come alive in this movie, which I think is very rare. You know, it's not just about the two leads, it's also about others. So that as just a directorial thing was interesting. Yeah, I just really like it. I like movies in which people fall in love. So I just, I am very, very corny that way, and perhaps a little sentimental. But I was also really interested in, you know, I think that one of the great challenges for the romantic comedy comes into existence basically under heteronormative, you know, and I think that one of the things that's been really interesting for the last 15 years or so is seeing mainstream movie companies kind of grappling with the fact that the old forms do not fit the new people, you know,
yeah.
Like it doesn't really work.
Right.
Once upon a time, you know, there are people like Stanley Cavell, who's written, you know, beautifully about the comedies of remarriage, that the romantic comedy had a certain kind of function in terms of like relations between heterosexual couples. But there's certain, you know, dynamics that change over year, and Hollywood, we know, really likes genres, and it doesn't really know how to change them to necessarily fit the times.
Right.
And so, blah, 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 what I'm trying to say is the romantic comedy just felt often very out of touch
yeah.
with how people live in the world. And I think it was really interesting, the kind of the emergence of the bromance for me was very much about the fact that, like, we can't deal with women good, so we're just going to deal with bros. But also, the bromance was very much about men trying to, you know, heterosexual men trying to be new men, different kinds of men, more sensitive men, men who have feelings, because those are movies with a lot of feelings, right? Sure, and that's really interesting. That, to me, is really kind of showing. And I think that then separately, there was emergence, I've written a little bit about this, so, you know, of like The Wedding Picture, which are very much about regulating femininity, I think, you know, where they're magic, you know, I'm a liberated gal, but I'm going shopping for my wedding dress, you know, and which I really like Bridesmaids because it kind of played with that, you know. But you had this kind of emergence of his and her romantic comedies in a certain way.
Interesting.
And especially for, this is heterosexual romantic comedy. Yep. But you had his, you know, romantic comedy and her romantic. Very often you don't have him and her together. Hmm. And I thought that there was something interesting about The Big Sick, in addition to the fact that it just made me laugh a lot, and it made me cry, and then I laughed some more, and then I cried some more, that it was actually kind of taking a subgenre that for me feels very often very dead and very kind of, you know, and I love, you know, and actually putting together a couple and allowing them to find each other. And it felt new, and in bringing in certain things like identity, you know, and what is it to be an American, and specifically was it to be a Muslim American?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And the fact that it put it into one big package, I was very happy.
Briefly, we should tell people what it's about.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I should have dived in.
No,
it's fine.
You're fine.
It stars Kumail Nanjiani. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Kumail. He pronounces like Kumail.
Kumail Nanjiani. And he and his wife, Emily Gordon, wrote the script, and it's about their courtship. And what was bizarre about their courtship is that they were seeing each other for a while, but then he was keeping it a secret from his family because they expected him to sort of carry on the Pakistani tradition of an arranged marriage. They broke up. Then she becomes very sick and actually goes into a medically induced coma that he happens to be the person at the hospital sitting with her because all of her other friends had finals or whatever, and he has to sign a form pretending to be her spouse to get her into the coma. So her parents show up, her parents know that they've broken up and are wondering why he's around, and but he nonetheless sort of sticks around through the process, and over the becoming close to the parents kind of comes to realize what he's missing out on, and so he's finally ready to commit to her, but when she wakes up, of course, she missed that part, and it's like, what are you doing here?
We broke up. Why are you in my hospital room?
Yeah.
By the way, I didn't say yes, sure, about how to pronounce his name because I was being dismissive, but because people in the film pronounce his name about three different ways.
I know.
Each time I was like, none of this is helping me. Like, I'm trying to get this guy's name just right, so I say it right, and none of y'all are giving me any clues.
I like this movie more than I liked Hello, My Name is Doris, which I had big problems with, and I don't love this movie, and a lot of people, you included, love this movie. and that's fine. I'm just, you know, but I'm less on board with it. I think there's a lot of very funny stuff in it.
Straight people.
Yeah, I know.
Fed up with them.
Stop taking up all the oxygen. No. I adore Holly Hunter and Ray Romano as the parents. I thought they were amazing, and I wanted a whole movie about them. I love the stuff about, he's one guy in the comedy club. He's one guy at home with the family. He's one guy with her. There's a lot of elements of the film that I like a lot. It is a Judd Apatow production, and I think like many of his films, it could lose a good 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I think it is a very visually drab movie. Like Dave was saying, like if you're going to shoot a movie that's set almost entirely in comedy clubs and hospital hallways, you either have to accentuate the drabness of those locations or come up with a way to make them look interesting, and the movie doesn't do either of those things.
I would say that most of Judd Apatow produced movies have not much going on.
Absolutely. No,
you know,
I agree.
Which is strange, yes. Because it's like, you can hire really good cinematographers.
He's very post-Kevin Smith in that way also.
He's not quite as bad as Kevin Smith.
Well, no, but I'm just saying. When we were talking earlier about people who I'd love to see somebody else direct their scripts, you know.
There Will Be Blood is my top movie. You know, I like myself a really beautiful, visually beautiful, like, sure. You know, and you know my interest in experimental films.
You contain multitudes.
I do. I do think that there is something to be said. So, but I don't think this is, I think this is actually a well-put-together movie. I would agree. Yeah, it could be a little bit shorter. Yeah, sure. But I didn't really feel that. I think that there's something to be said for, like, you know, the kind of, like, there are other things that I can, that I, if I'm not going to get visual pleasure necessarily from it, there are other things that I'm going to.
Agreed, absolutely.
Including from, you know, performances, you know, and how, again, I thought there was some, I really like how all the characters really, like, and I think it really is something that we don't necessarily, and I'm not talking about you, us in this room, but I'm just saying that movie critics in general, like, I think we have to tend to, like, performance is not just about the star or the, you know. Yeah. I think what Zoe Kazan does in this movie is really, really good. And she, Kumail Nanjiani is not a natural born actor, you know. Yeah. He's just not. And I like him. He's got a very winning kind of, like, screen presence.
Yes.
Partly because he's cute, you know. I mean, I'm going to say it. I think he's handsome, you know. And it's like, so, and he's
doesn't
got a,
hurt.
And doesn't ever hurt. And he's got a nice little smile, you know. Mm-hmm. But she does a lot of stuff that I think is really good. And I think in this case, this is a movie in which the performances really kind of, for me, made up for the lack of, like, visual interest necessarily. But it was not visually a movie that hurt my eyeballs either. So that,
no,
you know.
I'm with you. A lot of movies, I'm totally willing to, like, eschew, you know, the cinematography if the writing and the acting are super.
You know, the lack of direction. Like, even, you know, like, he's not doing a lot of stuff interesting with the camera. You know, it's not just cinematography. It's also, like, blocking and you know, in terms of staging. I think he could do certain things.
I
feel that way about most directors.
I think, yeah, Kumail Nanjiani, I don't think he handles the dramatic parts of this as well as
that's
he might have.
Strength,
and I think there are other, you know, when we talk about, like, what the rom-coms have been of late, like, a movie that I loved that very few people saw was The 7-Year Engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the Jason Segel and
5-Year Engagement.
5-year engagement?
10-year engagement.
5 years.
It's a long engagement.
Yeah, the engagement that went up a hill and came down a mountain. One of those. Anyway, you know, and I think that's a movie where, you know, I think somebody like Jason Segel can bridge those two things a little better, and maybe when things do get sad or upsetting or whatever, that it's you buy it more. And I think if he had bridged that divide more, I'd have been more on this movie's
maybe
side.
It was if he himself were a stronger actor. I think, but I think one of the smart things they do is they put a lot of good actors around
absolutely,
him, you know,
yes.
I mean, including the family, you know, I mean,
they were
the
great.
Family is brilliant. Yes. They're just all, the acting is really great.
And I liked that the parade of would-be arranged brides for him, like, they aren't the object of mockery. Like, those are treated very respectfully.
And they all get their moments. As performers, they all get their moments.
Yes.
You know, the truth is out there, you know, when that one way, you know. And it's like, she gets a big laugh. You know, that laugh is not given to him. I think that's a really, for me, that's a sign of kind of generosity, filmmaking generosity, where, and then the woman, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting her name, the woman who plays the nurse who actually explains things, like, she's a character.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's not just, you know, I wrote
an exposition dump.
Yeah, exactly. She's actually a character. She's not just background. You know, I felt like that was really important. I mean, I'm not saying that all romantic comedy's been terrible. There's been movies that I've really liked, you know, including gay movies that have been really, you know, great romantic comedies.
Sure.
I like one straight romantic comedy I liked a lot was Friends with Benefits.
I was going to ask you for something. I love that movie.
Me too. And I was so sad that it didn't take off.
Yeah.
And I just thought, people, this is what a romantic comedy should be.
When you were just now talking about rom-coms having to change with the way that romance happens in the world, that's the movie I thought of
absolutely.
Immediately.
It absolutely is. But a lot of them can't, and, you know, and so they just kind of run away from that. I think the problem is, like, you know, heterosexuality is very confusing.
Telling me.
I think a lot of the bromance is men, is straight men having to navigate straight male relationships in a world in which homosexuality exists.
That's right. But I think that's really interesting because it's like how,
visibly,
you know,
rather.
Remember the title of I Love You, Man,
yeah.
you know, which
yeah.
is a which is one of my favorite of the bromances.
Yes.
And because it really kind of gets at the issue of, like, of men who insulate themselves. There was an article recently about how loneliness is, like,
yes.
terrible for heterosexual men in particular,
yes.
who don't...
They're not allowed to touch each other.
Who are not allowed to touch each
right.
other, who, let's say, after a certain point, fall away from their other friends because and everyone becomes best friends with their wives, you know?
Yep.
And they don't have the same kind of community associations that necessarily gay men might have, you know, that it's really kind of interesting. And they become lonely and how, like, that's actually terrible for their health.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I Love You, Man is like, she realizes it's about a woman who realizes that her fiance has no friends.
Yeah.
So she needs to get him a friend. But actually, that's really poignant. It's about, like, you know, heterosexual, like, you know, heterosexual masculinity being at this point where they knew how to do it for so long.
Yeah. Like, you look at a movie like Wings, where, like, men could hug and even kiss
absolutely.
Each other. And,
absolutely.
And in a world in which gay men were, like, hidden,
absolutely.
That was fine. But once we emerged and ruined it for everybody else, straight guys couldn't figure
that's
out.
That's right.
Straight guys couldn't figure out how to
that was the plan
yes.
all along.
Straight guys had no idea how to touch each other anymore, you know.
But what you see in these movies is a kind of an attempt to navigate new masculine,
yes.
you know, new masculinity.
Paradigms,
absolutely,
yeah.
which is really fascinating. So,
so I'm glad The Big Sick exists. I liked it a lot, and I'm glad it exists for one very specific reason, and it's that there is a romantic comedy in the world with a Muslim American dude and his non-Muslim girlfriend. When do we get
more
mixed race,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Mixed religion, mixed everything films? We almost never get them.
Get Out.
Unless they're niche, you know.
And
or
that's a horror movie.
Or Get Out is a horror movie. So I'm thrilled that this is even a movie in theaters.
Sure.
And it doesn't minimize his Muslimness.
No, no, not at all. It's
goes,
essential to the character.
It goes well
plot,
in.
Yeah.
He makes jokes. Pretty
yeah, the,
serious jokes,
the,
too.
Like
about,
a really funny 9/11 well, joke.
Well, but it's actually, it's problematic. I mean, it's
not about 9/11. It's about the notion of talking about 9/11.
Right. It actually...
Yeah. Make that clear, please.
But it engages all these ideas. Like, it shows in a very kind of casual and I thought quite lovely way, you know, his family wants him to pray. And so I don't want to give away what he does, but it shows, like, here is a ordinary person who happens to also be a Muslim.
Yeah.
That's, you know, and this is an ordinary guy who really loves his family and is caught the way that I think that, you know, sometimes children, immigrants
yeah.
and are caught between two worlds. And it's, I love my parents and they've sacrificed a lot for me. But I also love this girl, this young woman
sure.
who, and you're caught in these two places. And I think it's, you know, it deals with identity politics in a way that it doesn't feel like identity politics,
right.
which I loved, you know? And I feel like when we see movies that come out of Sundance, let's say, I'm sorry, I beat up on Sundance sometimes, yeah. but I see a lot of good movies that come out of Sundance. But this is a movie that doesn't feel like it was made with a thesis in mind, you know? It's just that
right.
it's coming out of a lived experience. You
yeah,
know?
It's like I had no idea until the credits that it was actually a true story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah. I'm in a bubble.
Okay.
I don't look at
Dave,
trailers.
Dave was the one person who gasped at the end of Prometheus when it was an alien movie. And I'll tell you, speaking of Sundance, I didn't go this year, and there was a ton of raves for this movie out of Sundance. And I think hearing that for 6 months and then finally seeing it
yeah.
may have colored my, like, it's all right, but come on.
You know? No, I know. And that's part of why I like actually going to festivals is that you can get to go see the movies
oh,
before
yeah,
they're
no,
all
that's,
like, you
that's
know.
That's what I love about Venice, yeah.
You know, but I also try to stay, I mean, I try to keep up with what's happening but not reading about movies that are out, like Get Out also played at Sundance. I didn't see it there.
Uh-huh.
I actually didn't see Big Sick No, I saw Big Sick at Sundance, so I loved it right away. The Get Out plays at Sundance, and I didn't see it, but I just kind of kept myself away from
well,
it.
Well, I never
you know?
Read reviews, but
yeah,
like,
neither
there's just
I bore four after, but
there's just yeah, me neither. But there's just like there's it's in the air, and you can't
yeah,
you
I know.
Know
I try to avoid it. It's
just
wanna,
the headlines
right.
tell you everyone loves this thing. You know,
no, I know, and then it's terrible because then you feel like I mean, you felt like it happened with like someone who's talking about Tony Erdman, like it was overhyped, and you're just like, what are you supposed to do? We all love it. Are we supposed to pretend that we don't love
sure,
it?
No, no, absolutely.
Like it becomes this really difficult thing where it's just like, we loved it.
Yeah,
you know?
No, no.
I know.
It's nobody's fault. the
love is never anybody's
fault. The conversation that I find hilarious are the people on Twitter who are worried about, like, okay, everybody, don't go too crazy about The Big Sick now, or it won't get an F. It won't get as many Oscar nominations as it will if we
oh
don't talk about it too much now.
God.
I'm like, who cares?
And A, but also this movie actually needs help in terms of
yes.
expanding.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually in limited release right now, and you know, the only way it's going to get beyond a limited release is if people are enthusiastic about it now, and it will never ever be nominated, and who cares? You know,
right.
I would so love for our Oscar obsession to go away. It never will. But it's just. It really bums me out.
You know, a thing we didn't touch on earlier in talking about the sort of the current state of cinephilia, you know, is this, like, our friend Whitney Seibel just wrote a piece about, you know, the notion of the armchair executive, that average moviegoers are now getting obsessed with things like, not now, it's been going on for a while now, obsessed with grosses and,
these aren't,
you know,
average moviegoers. Well, these are young men.
Engaged, you know, internet people, like. And yeah, and there's
these
two
are young
things.
Men who love to collect information and stats and turn it into a game and then turn it into a serious game.
Right.
And that's fine. Have your game. Like, just do your thing.
And
don't get in my way.
Yeah.
Just get out of my way.
I want to talk about art. Thank you.
Yeah.
It also Venn diagrams with
nothing more tedious than talking about business when you should be talking about
art. Sure. And it also Venn diagrams with another type of cinemaniac, the people who basically treat movies like Pokemon, where they have to see everything and they have to like find the most obscure thing, you know, some movie that, like, there's probably a reason why it has been unseen for 50 years, but nonetheless, you know, you saw it, and
it's
that's
nice.
Important.
It's
nice.
I like the piece that Whitney wrote. He has a lot of great points, and it's nice, I think, when people are engaged with film, no matter what no matter what form it takes, as long as their engagement doesn't, like, get in my face and never stop talking, then we have a problem.
Right, because I follow the business, but it's more like I think of it as a hobby, you know?
Sure.
And I think it's important sometimes, and I'm interested in particular ways, like I'm interested in the business in terms of, like, women directors. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the terms of you know, basically non-white guy directors, get it, you know, and like how that works, and do black films really travel internationally or not, and things like that are really interesting, and that's actually really important to me. But just like basic numbers are kind of meaningless in a way, so I don't really.
What happened?
I just cut out my earphones. I think the batteries, because we've been talking for so long.
Yeah.
So it's just cutting out a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a diversion, and it's not the thing that is worth talking about.
I think it's the kind of people that, like, do those baseball statistics. Is it a similar kind of idea that you're doing all this, like, you know?
Kind of, yeah. It's like rotisserie, you know, that sort of. Yeah, and it just becomes this thing where, like, I don't care if, you know, if Pirates makes enough money in China that they make a sequel anyway. It's like, that's not keeping me awake at night, you know.
You're not Jerry Bruckheimer. I don't think.
Yeah.
Why should you be kept awake?
Exactly. But always a pleasure to have you here. You are a delight and always give us things to think about and talk about. Where can people find you online?
NewYorkTimes.com.
Also
on
Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Manola Dargis.
There you go.
Be kind.
Don't hide your light under a bushel, young lady. All right. So, yeah, this is a long episode, so I'm not going to give you the usual spiel of the end.
No DVD picks, no letters, no nothing.
Yeah.
Join our club.
Join our club.
Go to Patreon, Linoleum Knife. You'll find it.
Yes. And follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Linoleum Cast. And we'll be back next time with more. Thank you, Manola, for being here.
Thank you for having me. Yay!
We'll catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.